September 10th, 2019 session of Tangerine SDR, TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S. And this week I've been working on refamiliarizing myself with Phil Karn's talk from Albuquerque on multicast and unicast and how to make that work. So, and I've been playing some projects along those lines. So, that brings us to the list. Ward, you seem to be on Vox and picking up the main signal as well.
Hello.
Hello, Ward.
Hi.
And, anyway, to avoid the echoing, you can go to Tools, Options, Capture, and assign a push to talk button. So next on the list, we have, I believe it's G Perry, and it's KD2SAK. Go ahead.
Good evening, everybody. I'm just checking in, just seeing how things are going, and I'll let everybody get back to the meeting. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK, shown as recording away. We thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. So next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NNF.
Thank you very much, Dave. Things are going fine over here. Most of my week has been spent working on classes here at the University of Scranton.
Go ahead.
Ward is on Vox, and it's making it unintelligible here.
Okay, how do I turn off Vox? I'm looking at the options.
Hey, Dave, that's in the tools menu, right?
Options. Then you go to Capture, Push to talk. There's a button, and then you push the key. I have control L.
Okay, I just got it straightened out. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. It cuts back on the reverb.
Thanks, Ward.
But I like reverb.
Okay, we were talking to Nathan just a minute ago. W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Yeah. Thanks. Things are going fine here. I had another busy week at the University of Scranton. I've been doing a lot with classes. Let's see. I'm also, the DAISY grant has been awarded to NJIT officially, but now we're working on transferring that over to Scranton. So I'm working on doing some rebudgeting, and I think this is actually going to help the project a lot, having it go to Scranton, because we actually are able to spend quite a bit more money with that. So I've been working with Scotty. We're trying to get a budget there. We're going to have some collaboration with NJIT. We're going to, of course, have a collaboration with University of Alabama and Case Western and those groups. So we've been working on that. And I'm also working with a few students to try and get some of the radio projects I was working on last year back up and running as well. Back to Net.
Fine business. Next on the list, we have Ned. Go ahead, Ned.
Oh, hi. This is Ned, AA7A. I'll add that to my my name, whatever that is. Yeah, I represent the a team that's forming here that is going to be working with Nathan and Ward and others. It's a noise study project for the ARL's EMC lab. We're going to be putting in a receiving system at a remote site here in southeastern Arizona. And I am sitting in on this discussion to learn what I can about the Tangerine SDR, which may be a candidate receiver for that system. So Scotty, good to hear you, hopefully. And I'll be looking forward to listening in on the net here tonight. Thanks a lot.
Fine business, Ned. Welcome. Next on the list is Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and good evening to everybody on TeamSpeak tonight.
I put together a list of A to D converters that we might consider for the receiver and sent that to Scotty. That was one of the action items from a week ago. And surprised to found at least 80 different parts that would be candidates. So the Excel spreadsheet is sortable and filterable and all of that kind of stuff. Secondly, I talked with or emailed with Phil Erickson, and we agreed to use relays on the receiver to switch the noise source in and out. And I used the noise source to measure the noise figure of the Hermes-Alex combination. And a little bit of uncertainty due to the noise figure being up around 8.5 dB or so, but generally good results and easily able to resolve the difference in noise levels from a 5 dB excess noise ratio source. And I still have on the list to put together a discussion list for DCC. I don't have that done yet. So back to you, Dave.
Fine business. And next on the list is Ward. And let's see, it's N0AX, right? Go ahead, Ward.
Right. Nothing and unknown. My role in this, as far as the noise study goes, is to make introductions and help the conversation move along and not get in the way too much here. I think both projects have a lot of common elements, and it would be great to have overlap. There's a lot of buzz about citizen science, and I think the noise study could take advantage of that. On the magnetometer, I've been talking with Gary Sutcliffe, W9 X-ray Tango, and he is going to help look into making a completely standalone magnetometer that does not require a computer support, but is data compatible with the rest of the architecture. And Unified Microsystems is a relatively well-known small manufacturer for ham radio stuff. So Gary's pretty skilled about this. He understands magnetometers, microprocessors, et cetera, and is willing to help out. So at some point, we can have a talk about how to make a standalone unit that's compatible with the group's design and why that is a good thing. But for now, that's my role. Back to Ned.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Dave, for taking up the banner here and running with this. And welcome to Ned and Ward. I'm glad to see you guys here. I was hoping we'd get to talk to you about making sure that any features that we get in built into the Tangerine will be useful for the noise measurements that you guys are spearheading. And I'd really like to hear more about the magnetometer, Ward, to see what kind of sensitivity you get and resolution, because that's kind of critical for us to be down in the 1 to 5 nanoteslas kind of range, if that's what you're thinking. Ours is going to be a PMOD-based unit, so it will actually run on an I2C port, so you can hook it up to a Raspberry Pi or, you know, multitudes of single-board computers. But the standalone one, I'm guessing you're going to have some kind of display or something on it. But I'd be interested to hear how you're going to communicate the results out. So this week I've been working on making schematic symbols, and I've got our CAD guy already working on CAD decals, part decals for the connectors and for the ICs for the data engine, and put the finishing touches on the mechanical mock-up for the Tangerine SDR that I'm going to take to DCC next 2 weeks. Actually leave this Saturday. I'm going to go on a family visit to visit my brother in Missouri and spend some time there, and then onward to Detroit. So I guess that's it for here for this week. So back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And oh, we had Holman Kim come in there. I don't, he's got his mic muted, but for the recording, just to announce who's here. He is here. He's one of the scientists who works with Nathan. So that brings us to the end of the list, and we're open for general discussion.
Scotty, did you get a chance to look at the A to D converter list?
Yeah, I did. It looks like most of them are going to be probably beyond our price range for the introductory, although I guess we could stretch it a little, but sounds like there's a couple you have identified that would be good candidates, especially serial LVDS one that goes along with the 2145. I think it's on the line right above it. So is that your assessment also?
Well, there the serial LVDS one is the unit, I think, that runs double data rate, quad data rate, or octal data rate on the interfaces.
Oh, that's going to be a problem at the speed we're going.
Yeah, I one of the other ones, there's an analog devices converter that is a little bit over 12 effective bits, and the dual module looked pretty competitively priced.
Let's see, analog device. Oh, one of the top ones. Okay. Yeah, it's the $76 one.
No, there was like a $51 one.
Okay, am I not? I only see about, this is interesting. Why on my Excel spreadsheet does it skip many, many, many lines?
You have the filters turned on. If you go to the top row, you can see filters, and you can click on it and change the filter selection.
Okay, that sounds like an operator error problem. Okay, I'll take a look at this. So there's, because it seemed like you had said there were like 80 or 90, and here I'm seeing like only a dozen.
Yeah. One of the ones I was looking at is an analog device is 9648.
Okay, I see the 9640.
Okay, if you look for AD 9648-125, it's two channels, 125 megasample, 75 dB SNR, and it's a fully parallel interface for $51.
Okay, I still haven't figured out how to turn the filtering off. I don't see a filter button on Office 365 here. So have I got a newer version than you have?
Should be a funnel, Scotty. Look for a funnel.
Ah, there it is.
User joined your channel.
I teach some Excel in my day job.
There it is, 9648. Okay. Oh, that's much better.
Hey,
and,
Tom,
does that do differential, Tom, or is that single-ended outputs only?
I think it's LVDS parallel.
Okay, that might work. It seems to have a little bit better signal to noise than the LTC one.
Yeah, I looked the that one. It computes out to about 12 effective bits, and some of the LTCs were down at 11.6 effective bits or something. So it looks good. The ones used on Hermes Light or the ones that Phil were using were about 12.6 effective bits. It was interesting, the 16-bit and the 14-bit converters of the style that Phil used both have the exact same number of effective bits.
Well, that's interesting. And are they? Is the 14-bit one significantly cheaper?
I think it is.
Yeah. Well, I always wondered about, you know, maybe we're overspecking ourselves, and we there's other things that we're doing that degrade the path more than the ADC does.
Yeah. The one I was looking at, its SNR is within about 2 dB, maybe 3 dB of the other part, but it's for two channels, it's like half the price.
But was the one Phil was using, is that a dual channel or is that the 2208?
He used a single channel. And so if you use two of those, that makes the price quite a bit higher.
Yeah, and of course we need two channels. So I think we're probably optimized for a dual channel unit.
Yeah, that one popped out as being, reasonably good combination of sampling rate, SNR, parallel interface and a reasonable price tag. Okay, well, look that over during the week and give me any thoughts you might have on it.
Can I interrupt a minute?
Go ahead.
We've got some new people, Dave, KD0EAG. Dave, do you have any comments real quick?
Nothing real quick. I've just been occupied with a catastrophe, I suppose.
Oh, another one of your raccoon problems?
No, this was really a cat problem, but all the same.
Also, Hume Kim turned his light on. I don't know if he wants to make a comment or not.
Oh, hi, this is Hume Kim. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Okay, I'm still trying to learn how to use like this TeamSpeak application. So, I wasn't so sure what the the protocol here. So I just unmuted my microphone so I can people can talk to me. Actually, this is my first time to join. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm just here to, you know, I like to defer all these technical engineering details to you guys, as you guys are much more experienced with this hardware details. I'm just here to assist you in, you know, making sure that the magnetometer that we are developing is scientifically useful in terms of like resolution, dynamic range, and sensitivity, stuff like that. So the magnetometer that I recommended you guys is I think fairly useful in terms of scientific investigation. Previously we had only a magnetometer that can be used for cell phone application, which is not appropriate for this type of scientific investigation. So I think we actually chose a correct one. The only thing that I'm not so sure so far is that whether this is going to be useful for long-term measurements. This is something that hasn't been really, I guess, verified, even from the company. So I don't know if you guys have used this magnetometer for a long time. Long-term measurement.
Well, Holm, I wanted to let you know that Dave W, KD0EAG, has one of those boards and has been testing it. So maybe during the time you might want to talk to each other.
Okay.
So Dave, pardon me. I was just going to ask Dave, he said two weeks ago, I think there was a problem with the manufacturer of that chip that they were filing bankruptcy or something. Did you find anything more out about that, Dave?
I haven't found anything more about it. I really wasn't terribly concerned. I assume the intellectual property part of it, if there's anything commercially viable there, it's going to continue. It was just really a curiosity that I had stumbled across that bankruptcy thing that I showed to Dave. So far, I'm really not concerned. Of course, they're not going to tell me if I ask. So, but I doubt there's any big problem there.
Okay. Well, Ward, can you tell us a little bit about the one you're working on to see how maybe Heilman can pass some judgment on it and say, yay, this is good, this is sensitive enough, but if we get some parameters from you, some performance data.
Okay, thanks. Gary and I talked about this, and we don't want to invent a separate implementation for the magnetometer. What we'd like to do is, if it's power efficient enough, is to use a remote extender module as described in the architecture with the magnetometer, the RM3100 from PNI, with that module on the REM. So it would be de facto identical with the one that's currently being proposed for the personal space weather station. And then we would support that with either a short Ethernet cable, very short Ethernet cable, to an Arduino Mega with a Wi-Fi module, or we could just do the magnetometer module itself and use I2C to talk to an Arduino Omega with a ESP8266 Wi-Fi module. And then the idea being that this thing would be powered by a battery with some external power options, like maybe a solar panel, and you put this thing out by itself, so it would be away from potentially distorting magnetic fields, that sort of thing. And the Arduino would be responsible for waking up every so often and taking the necessary data. And then at a predetermined interval, package it up in a file and email it to wherever the data collection is taking place. And I assume University of Alabama. So the idea of this standalone magnetometer would be to create an instrument that could be used by a group that doesn't have the resources to deal with a full personal space weather station. I'm thinking of the archetypal second grade class that wants a science project, and so they get a grant to grab one of these things and stick it out in the playground somewhere. And so they have a data point that's scientifically useful. It would have the same specs as the magnetometer that's being envisioned for the personal space weather station. The question is basically, how do we power it, whether we need to have all the Ethernet stuff if we want to use an REM remote extender module, or whether it's simpler to just go I2C into an Arduino and then out with Ethernet. I have a couple of block diagrams that I'll send to the group. I had hoped to get to that today, and I haven't gotten there yet. So Dr. Kim, if you are satisfied with the PNI RM3100 module performance, then we're good to go. But we don't envision forking the process here. We want to use whatever the PSWS decides to use for a magnetometer, but just make it into a standalone instrument. So all the data is totally compatible with the personal space weather station. It's just from a different source. I'm open for questions.
Yeah, Ward. Well, I guess Dave was on there. Dave was working on a remote version of the magnetometer chip. And I think maybe I'd love to see us be able to utilize the same hardware and reuse at least a piece of it. So go ahead, Dave.
Well, Ward, I'd like to talk to you about that some more. I doubt there's any conflict between what we're doing. I have been trying to test it with just an I2C extender. Initially, I had set up my little my little test bench board to use. I was also planning to get to trying to use LoRa signaling, but I have a lot of hardware for that, but I hadn't got that far and I wasn't wasting my time with it for now. But I'd like to coordinate with you and whatever ideas you're doing. As I said, I've had some veterinary adventures today that have kept me from finishing up a report on this, but I would be happy to show you what I've done and compare and contrast capabilities.
Okay, that sounds good to me. Yes, I want to make sure we have a minimum number of hardware configurations. I think we're on the right track. Your architectural element was tethered to the personal space weather station, and ours is completely independent. It may be that we can use the same internal hardware and reconfigure it in some way, and that would make it a lot easier. But I'll exchange email with you and send these block diagrams back and forth. Dr. Kim, we had some questions. Gary and I had some questions about, if I can get this to come up on my screen here. There it is. Okay. Whoop. Nope. It disappeared. Okay. Anyway, about data resolution, frequency of measurements, number of bits per sample, et cetera, and we can take care of that offline, I think. Anyway, back to Ned.
Yeah, okay, Ward, I have a couple comments. I'd like to kind of describe the architecture that we are planning. I was hoping Dave would do that, but he's down in the throes of dealing with the cat problem, I guess. So, but the idea was to take the board that he bought from the manufacturer, and put, we have to keep it about at least 100 feet away. Got to be able to have 100 feet of range of sitting it out in the yard or outside someplace. So the idea is we put an I2C extender on the board. We'll design a custom board which will have the chip on it, the magnetometer chip or the chipset with the sensors, and an I2C extender. We're going to use Cat5 cable, so an RJ45 connector, even though it's not going to be Ethernet, it's going to be just Cat5 cable because it's cheap and plentiful and the connectors are easy to come by. It's going to run into an interface board on the other end, which is basically just I2C, the other end of the I2C extender, and it's going to come out with a PMOD port. And a PMOD port is basically just an I2C port. And I believe Arduino has an I2C port. So we ought to, if we work this right, we ought to be able to make these boards such that you can plug it right into an Arduino and have a very low cost standalone system. And that's I think that's what you're aiming for, right, Ward?
Yeah, that's correct.
This is Nathaniel, some comments too.
Okay, I was confused about the reference to an Ethernet cable on the Tangerine magnetometer document. That makes a lot more sense, and I'm all for that. It may be that, it may be as simple as simply not supporting the I2C interface in the standalone unit so that it doesn't have to connect to a space weather station and reprogram the Arduino to handle Gmail. Nathaniel had a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the Case Western Group, they're supposed to be coming out with a low-cost version of a space weather station, including that's probably going to be Raspberry Pi-based and will have a radio receiver instrument, but it's also supposed to be compatible and include a magnetometer as well. So I'm hoping that whatever magnetometer solution we all come up with, it can be duplicated, use the same hardware as many times as possible.
Yeah, when we wrote the document, the Ethernet cable just refers to the physical cable, meaning Cat5 with RJ45s on it. The protocol over the cable is I2C, and the interface on the PMOD connector that Scotty was talking about is I2C. So everything runs at I2C at the 100 kilobit per second rate.
Yeah, so if we work this right, we ought to be able to take the magnetometer with the I2C extender, restrap it, and hook it directly to the Arduino and have a magnetometer hooked to an I2C using the same exact board. If you want to run it 100 feet away, you change the straps to remote operation, put it out in your yard on a stake, run some Cat5 cable to it, take the other end of the board, other end of the system, which is another little paddle board, and you can use flying leads and hook it to an I2C port on an Arduino, and you can use the exact same hardware for both. And in fact, the magnetometer is not designed for the personal space weather station. The magnetometer is a magnetometer. It just happens to be usable on the personal space weather station, and if we do it right, a whole bunch of other places. So I just wanted to make that clear.
I wanted to say too, Ward, all the experiments I've been doing with this are with code I've written through the Arduino IDE. I'm actually using a SAMD51, I think, board from SparkFun to run the code, but that's pretty much irrelevant. I was going to move the library to a Wiring Pi based once I got done with the Arduino, and so I could run on any Raspberry Pi sort of board that supported fast enough I/O.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of why we use a PMOD connector on the data engine, because it's a standard interface. And so figuring that if we use a standard interface, we can connect to a Pi or an Arduino or a BeagleBoard or anything you want.
Yeah, so, let me jump in here. Thanks. I think we're a lot closer together than what I thought. There's no Ethernet in there at all. Whoever is the owner of that document, it would be great if you would change the label Ethernet cable to just Cat5 and put a note in there carrying I2C, because I thought it meant the whole full Ethernet majesty of the interface, and I'm glad that it does not. So yeah, I think we're a lot closer. Go ahead.
Oh, I have one question. So no matter what type of platform this personal weather station will be using, will be using Arduino for anyways for data communication transfer?
The plan, I think, is to use a single board computer, either Raspberry Pi 4 or an Odroid N2 or we're going to pick one or two that we're going to standardize on is that's my view. I don't know how it's going to actually end up. It'll depend on what people want to write code for, I suspect, and what kind of horsepower we get. I know Bill from University of Alabama has been working on the networking software, and he's been using an N2, and he's getting very good performance out of the Odroid N2.
So I believe there will be some kind of main, like electronics, that takes all the data set and then transfer data. And on top of that, there will be additional electronics that will be running the magnetometer. Is that how I understand?
Well, I think, Nathaniel, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, we're going to try to incorporate the magnetometer data in with the SDR IQ data in HF5 format and put metadata on the front end so you can identify what data it is in the packets. Is that how we're going to do it, Nathaniel?
Yeah, well, exactly under the hood what happens, I'm not entirely sure, but the top level view is that there's going to be one standard API that will be able to accept the magnetometer data and the SDR data and whatever other data that these personal space weather stations might collect. And they will all go to a single database at the University of Alabama.
Okay, thanks.
But the idea is if we do the hardware right, you ought to be able to satisfy the people who want to use an Arduino and use a magnetometer and run their own software and for some other application that we don't even know about.
That's right.
The more people that want hardware, the cheaper it'll be.
Well, I think this could probably serve as a prototype for any low bandwidth analog instrumentation that we come up with in the future if it has a simple measurement protocol. But anyway, I feel like this has been a very good conversation. I'll change my block diagrams and send it to Dr. Kim and Dave and Scotty, and I think we'll probably be pretty close.
Okay, and feel free to post on the Tangerine SDR list also.
Okay, I will. Thanks.
Ward, I wanted to just make one little word of warning. If you're thinking about actually getting your hands on any of the hardware, there are two different boards that the magnetometer that PNI sells that are identical, but one of them is twice the cost of the other, and the only difference is that it has pins soldered on it, just 10th inch pins, and it costs like 60, I don't know how much, but be sure and buy the cheaper one.
That's a pretty good assumption since I'm a ham radio operator. Okay, no problem. And sorry to hear about your kitty. I'm a big kitty guy myself. Okay, back to Ned.
Yeah, we figured you'd probably know how to solder, Ward.
Well, I've been known to do that.
So I'm not sure I'm going to have the, I was going to try to have a prototype placement done, a preliminary placement done by the time I get to DCC, but it's looking like our CAD guy is pretty busy and we may not get it done in time. So at any rate, we'll still have the mechanical mock-up to throw darts at and see if we can find reason to change things around. But it looks like I may not get the preliminary placement in time.
Okay, well, as long as you have the mock-up, we can take pictures of it.
Yeah, it took an inordinate amount of time to chisel out all those finger-type connectors.
Did you do all 140 pins?
Well, I just use solid copper clad, so there's no electrical connections. It's just mechanical connections. So I basically just took the nibbler and I nibbled out clearance to put the connectors in. So everything plugs together. It's just that there's obviously there's one big net on the entire board. Or as I like to say, it's only just missing a few ICs and it'll be done.
Yeah, just a little bit of copper, a few components, some ICs, a little bit of layout, silkscreen solder mask. And a couple thousand hours of engineering, and you're there.
That's right. It's just knowing which copper to remove, right? So I think you're going to like the size of the RF boards, RF modules. They're bigger now. They're 110 by 50 millimeters. So that gives us quite a bit more room, I think, than we originally had.
Okay. You said 110 by 50?
110 by 50, and we may even, we'll discuss this at DCC, I think, but we may have to extend the connectors, the board, another 10 millimeters, because I want to use end launch SMAs, and if I use a through-hole connector in the board above it, then the end launch SMA is short against the pins due to the board clearance. So I either have to use a surface mount header above it, which means there's no pin sticking through, or we have to extend the board out so the SMAs clear the bottom of the pins sticking through the board above it. And then we'll just have a low clearance area in front of the SMAs. But anyway, I talked to our CAD guy. We're going to actually come up with CAD drawings of all four boards, of where the connectors are going to be, exactly positioned, what the connectors part numbers are, and where the keep out areas are and where the height limitations are on each board. So it'll be easy for anyone who wants to build a compatible board to just take a look at that. We'll put it all in the ICDs, and you can just pull up the ICD for that board. You'll be able to make one.
Okay, it'll be interesting. I'm still just a little mentally fuzzy on how it's all going to go together. I think you're having your prototype at DCC will really help a lot.
Yeah, after plugging it all together, I'm trying to figure out how I would explain it without the model, and I don't think I can. It's like I'm not eloquent enough to do that.
Oh, well, engineers are graphically oriented anyway.
You plug that one into that one, and it works. And I guess the other question is the size of the leaf board, or the low-speed expander, is pretty much the size of a Raspberry Pi hat. So there's not really much you can do on that. The size of the clock module I'm a little worried about, because it's quite a bit smaller than I anticipated. And I think those GPS DOs, the U-blocks parts, aren't they relatively large?
I'm trying to think. They're kind of like the size of a 24-pin dip, except twice as wide.
So like 1.2 inches wide and about 2 inches tall.
I don't think they're quite that big, but yeah, there's something in that, in the inch by inch or something size range.
Okay, well, that's doable. It's just that there's not much room left for the ancillary ICs. I can't remember. I think I've got the size set at like 40 by 60 millimeters.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll have to talk to whoever is doing that. You have to also get the four-channel synthesizer, the crystal for the synthesizer, the D to A, the temperature compensated VCTCXO crystal.
Yeah, and there's a limited amount of height on the backside, although I did choose the higher M.2 connectors, so we have 4.1 millimeters clearance between the two boards, which is enough to put parts on, might even get parts on both boards. But the other thing is that the way I've arranged the boards is every board has at least one dimension that it can be extended. So if you need to extend the clock module, you can extend it out. It'll hang over the edge of the data engine, but at least there's a free edge that doesn't depend on anything, so you can extend it. And with the low-speed parallel module, same thing. And for the second version of the data engine that has a bigger FPGA on it and we need more space, you can grow the data engine both in the plus and minus X direction, so and still maintain the connector positions of the other boards. So I think we have room to grow and for all boards and all, not in all directions, but at least in one direction for every board.
Okay, the module is 17.8 millimeters by 23.4 millimeters, and the height is 4.1 millimeters.
Okay, so that would have to go on the top of the board, but that would work, I think. That takes up less than half of the space of the board. In fact, more like less than a quarter of the space, so I think we're good.
Well, yeah, that's just that one module. There's, you know, there's an SMA connector, there's a synthesizer chip, a couple of crystals, you know, so there's a fair amount of other stuff.
Right, but I have the two SMAs mounted on the prototype to show how they would go. I think two is enough. I hope two is enough. You have a reference in and a GPS antenna. Do we need more than two?
Well, it's on the ICD. I think there were two SMAs on the ICD.
Yeah, that's what I remember. Okay, so, and then we have three quarters of the board space left for the crystal and the crystal oscillator and the clock smoother chip, the jitter reducing chip, and I think we're okay. And the jitter reducer, it's probably a TSOP or a TSSOP. It may be able to be put on the back side.
Yeah, that chip has some very stringent layout requirements in order to meet jitter. It has its own crystal, different from the GPS oscillator, and it has some significant power and ground separation requirements.
Yeah, and I'm sure if with those four outputs running to the edge connector, we're going to have to place it right near that edge connector,
and then the GPS, but then the GPS will go on the opposite end closer to the antenna connector. So I think we can do it. The other issue is that the M.2 boards, the parallel board and the GPS module, they have to be 031 thick boards. They have to be thin, the thin PC board, because that's what size the connectors require.
Okay, well, I don't know if thinness is going to be an issue. It should only be an issue if there's multiple layers. How many layer board can you get in a 031?
That's a good question. It depends on how much separation you want between the layers. So if you have like controlled impedance and many layers, we might run into some problems there.
Okay. I don't know how many, you know, the receiver, I haven't looked at how many layers it's going to be. The multiplier, I think, was a four-layer board.
And I'm thinking you could probably get at least six-layer boards in 031 and maybe even eight-layer boards. And then there, we did actually one for a customer a while back. We actually made an 062 board, and we milled down the connector to 031 and plated the gold on top of that and connected up that way. And it's, the trouble with that is it's really expensive to do.
Yeah. So that that's a possibility. The A to D converter on the receiver, I think, needs a thermal and RF slug underneath it. And I was looking at the analog devices layout guidelines. They have a document for how to do circuit board layout for the part, and it requires an all layers thermal slug.
Yeah. So you're just going to get a couple fewer layers, but it actually might be better because the layers will be closer together on an 031 board, so you get better heat transfer between them. But does it need a heat sink or anything on the top, or just the pad underneath it?
I think it's just a pad underneath it. I've got the power dissipation numbers in the spreadsheet I sent you.
Oh, okay. I'll take a look at that, because I know the 2208 dissipated upwards of a watt, like a watt and a quarter for a single channel. So I'm expecting these dual channel ones at 122 megahertz to dissipate a couple of watts.
Oh, no. I'll bring up this. Hang on. When I hit my control key to talk, it causes some of my other software programs to do strange things.
So that power listing that you have, it says 299 milliwatts. Is that per channel or is that total?
I'm bringing it up. Hang on. I think that's the total device power dissipation.
Oh, that's very good then.
Yeah, you'll notice the older parts are up around a watt for two channels, and the newer generation of parts, they're down, you know, to like 180 milliwatts for one channel, 250 milliwatts for two channels. So the newer generation parts seem to be a lot lower power.
Yeah, do you have any idea what like a Lime, like a, what's it, 7000 series, a Lime, what's on the Lime SDR Mini? Do you remember what kind of power it takes?
No idea.
I think we'd like to do at some point an RF module with a Lime part on it.
Okay. Well, I don't know any, I don't have any data on the Lime converters.
It seems to me that it runs off of USB power, so can't be too much.
Okay. Well, at any rate, I haven't checked the power on the A to D driver, but that and the A to D converter ought to be the two dominant power consumptions on the module.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So really, then the thing is going to be making sure we get all the voltages compatible, because it seems like the 245 was, I think, a 1.8 volt A to D. I didn't look at the other one to see what it was.
Yeah, the analog devices part is 1.8 volt power.
Okay, so we probably ought to make sure we have the capability to set the I/O channels to either 1.8 or 2.5.
Okay, the analog devices part can have a separate digital output supply to accommodate 1.8 volt CMOS or LVDS logic families is what it says.
Okay, but it can't go higher than 1.8 volts on the outputs, right?
I'm going to have to dig into the data sheet.
An interesting fact on the 2145 was that the outputs are 1.8 volts, but the inputs are all 3.3 volt tolerant. So you could actually drive the inputs with 3.3 volt logic to, you know, all the control inputs and all that, but the data outs would be 1.8. So if you didn't have the threshold set properly, you'd have trouble.
User in your channel timed out.
Well, really looking forward to DCC. Have you had a chance to look at the schedule, Tom?
think Tom timed out.
Oh, he did. Darn computers. So, hey, I have a question for Ned there. I was talking to Ed Hare at Hamvention, and he seemed pretty excited about the prospect of using this for an RF sniffer for power lines. Did he talk to you any about that?
Well, yeah, we're monitoring this. We kind of want to deploy, in the near term. And so we may go with some currently available receiver. But yeah, the concerns, the challenges, at least for the project we have, is it is a remote site. It's not air conditioned. It's not heated. So it's going to be very hot and very cold. And I'm not sure what the how much coddling we would need to apply to use it out at that site. I mean, the site where our station is, I mean, the remote site is a multi-transmitter contest site located in a Lordsburg, New Mexico school bus. And inside that bus, it gets to 135 degrees before we turn on the amplifiers during the summer, and it gets well below freezing in winter. So some real environmental challenges. But the site has a receiving farm to die for. It's got a system of 16 what are called beverage antennas, which are directive arrays that can monitor the low frequency spectrum, 1 meg to 10 megs in 16 different directions. And it's one of the quietest places around. So it's some real opportunities to study noise. Our first job is going to be to baseline the noise characteristics of HF in a quiet location. And then we'll start looking to see if we can monitor some technology that's rolling out that is expected to cause upsets to the noise spectrum in urban areas. We think we can monitor them from out there if they propagate in. So that's the objective. So this receiver would fit in fine out there, and it might be exactly what we need. So I'm going to keep an eye on this to see where it's going. Go ahead.
Okay. What kind of internet connectivity do you have? This is Milt's old site, right?
That's correct. Last we checked, it's about 150 meg up and down. The area, the WAN router is 25 feet away from the school bus.
Okay, perfect. So that'll be perfect. And what I'm thinking is for your beverage farm is I'd like to see a 16-channel receive board that would be used just to receive receive RF off the beverages all simultaneously, and then feed it into the SDR and process it.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, the way it's configured currently, we have two muxes that are controlled by the two stations out there. So either station can select any of the antennas, but that's could be changed. No big deal. That would be interesting. Yeah, I mean, the SDRs are cheap, and putting 16 there would not be that hard.
Yeah, one of the things we're trying to plan for is to be able to synchronize multiple Tangerine SDRs together, so you can really expand it as far out as within reason at a local location. But I'm thinking in your case, for because you're using the beverages on up to only about 2 megahertz probably, so we can cut the ADC speed down, and if we can filter it well enough, filter out the above 10 megahertz stuff, clock the ADCs at 20 megahertz, use cheaper ones, and just build a multi-channel board.
Interesting. Yeah, well, we use the beverages, on 160 and 80, but they work in the AM band just fine. In fact, I calibrate them or check them, listening to those 10-watt AM stations above 1600 up in Denver. One of them happens to be right in Borsai on one of the antennas, and we listen to it all day long. So it's kind of cool.
Wow, you can hear it during the daylight hours?
Roger, roger.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That's interesting. Of course, since they're directional, I'm not sure how much advantage you're going to get to doing any kind of phasing with them, but at least you would you could listen to all of them at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's complicated. The antennas are slow wave antennas. They kind of a very lossy, leaky, low velocity coax kind of signals propagate in free space. They couple on the line and add to energy that was intercepted further up the line. So it kind of acts like, if you're familiar with helix transmitters, it's it's kind of, so I don't know the phasing. I don't know what you mean by phase of a signal and that kind of an antenna. Plus their feed points are physically separated by, you know, 1,000 feet or so. So it's be a complicated problem to sort out that sort of an array, but we are going out there in a week to survey the site, get the position of the antennas down pretty tight. So we could talk about something like that. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. It's just like a traveling wave antenna, if I remember right. But I was thinking it might be more appropriate just to be able to receive them all at once and process them in parallel. So you could basically pick the best one without having to switch anything around. I mean, you tune to a particular frequency and say, okay, I want to listen to the JA, so it's going to be that particular direction. But, you know, we all know how propagation works. Sometimes the one aimed the right direction isn't necessarily the one that the signal's coming in from.
Yeah, propagation's funny. You know, another thing, not many people have an antenna like this available to them, and we do. And I've had using it for 3 years. And people talk about these modes of propagation, and I find it interesting, but I have never experienced some of the ones that they have. Something that Milt learned when he built, this is not his first polka. He built his first 16 beverage array where they all emanated from a single point, went out radially. And he found after 5 years that doesn't work, that they couple too much to each other. And so you really aren't listening to one antenna, no matter which one you select, you're really listening to all of them. So the new array, the one we have, they're all at right angles to each other. So there is no interaction between them. So a lot of people who build something and think it works one way, it works a different way. And so the models in their head they come up with are maybe explain what they're hearing, but it's not what's happening. So it's interesting to study, wear the headphones and study signals for a long time. A lot of interesting things go on.
Yeah, that is interesting observation because, you know, typically the ham is going to want to run all the beverages back to his operating position and just aim them the direction he wants. And then you don't get the desired result or the result you expect. It's quite interesting. Anyway, it sounds like you might be a very good candidate up there for a beta tester.
Yeah, I would be happy to do that. We go up there a lot. And my idea is to make this thing modular so I can go up there, remove a tray, replace it with a different tray so that we can swap out parts of this thing and check various things out. It's a 4-hour drive out there, so it's a full day to do anything. If I go up there and just touch it, it's a day. And so we don't like to work out there a long time, so it has to be pretty well rehearsed and ready to put in when you get out there.
Yeah, and one of the things that we're looking at is firmware updates over the internet so that you can actually upgrade the FPGA code without having to go visit the site, which would be probably welcome relief for your 4 hours up and 4 hours back.
Yeah, we do that all the time with all the radios and everything.
All right, sounds good. Well, welcome aboard. I'm glad to see you here and have to get over to a meeting one of these days.
Yep, good stuff. We'll keep. I don't know if I'll be on this. It's either me or Kristen, K6WX. She's probably more in the software domain. I'm the hardware guy.
Okay, well, Kristen's welcome.
Okay, all right, glad to be aboard.
Scotty, this is Tom. I'm back. My internet connection dropped out. The analog devices digital I/O is 1.8 volts only.
Okay, so we better be able to handle that or else. Yeah, so I think what we'll do is we'll end up making each one of the six LVDS channels a different I/O bank, and we'll make them strappable.
Scotty, I wanted to let you know, you came in after I gave my little thing, but I've been spending a little time with the multicast software that Phil Karn presented last year at BCC. There are some possibilities of using something in that nature.
So what would we have to do to add that capability to something like the IQ2?
Well, it's basically the receiver driver in that. And then there are some networking quirks that you have to work around that he talks about. But at least at a wired level locally, it works beautiful.
Well, so basically we would just build the UDP packet, go to
a multicast address instead of to a unicast address, right? Is there other things that have to be done?
No, that's about it. And there's just some things. I'm working through it and building some test beds to see if it works the way I believe it does, so that I can't just pick up stuff in the middle, so I have to figure out what's actually going on before I like to go ahead and go forward.
Yeah, I know that feeling. And maybe at DCC you get a chance to talk about some programming stuff too, if you have time.
Yeah, well, I could say something about it. There's some very interesting technology we should be able to take advantage of. So, but it's all not even where you guys are with the hardware.
Well, it's just that we have to make sure that we don't do something stupid in the hardware that precludes us from being able to upgrade over Ethernet and be bomb-proof, so in case power interrupts or something during an update, we can recover from that without having to drive up somewhere.
That's right. Well, the one thing that I do have in my pocket is 10 years of experience with OpenXDR, so as far as updating firmware. So I have some idea how that works and what things people are adding now that we really need to add at the beginning on this one.
Well, the interesting thing about the Max 10 is it has room in the FPGA in the flash image to store two programs. So basically you put the bootloader in one program and you put the operating firmware in the other, and then you overwrite the operating firmware. And if you mess up and you break it, it actually checks the checksum while it's loading. If it detects a corrupt image, it automatically reboots the other image. And so you just leave one image alone, never touch it. So you've got a golden bootloader image. And so theoretically, then you can't really break yourself.
Ah, I see. For the Max 10, is there something equivalent to your Aero A9 board that could be used to play with the FPGA?
Yeah, actually there is. I just Dan and I just bought one for iCloud Labs. It's called a M10K or M0198. It's the Max 10 board that Terasic sells, and it has a HSMC connector and 2 gigabit Ethernet connectors on it, and it's $200. So I thought, well, with 2 Ethernet connectors and an HSMC, I could plug a 9361 board on that HSMC connector. So I think it's usable for what we're doing for testing some code. Also, they claim it runs 2 1-gig Ethernet ports and it meets timing, which is something that we're having trouble doing on the Hermes board. But it does use a faster speed grade than the default of the Max 10, which I think has convinced me to use the Max, the higher speed grade on the data engine, because I think we're going to need it to go full speed on the gigabit Ethernet.
Well, yeah, that's good. I was just hoping that we could have a test bed to try things before we actually need to have it working.
Well, this is going to come out pretty fast because the data engine has a slot on it that you can plug an HF1 or HF2 in, so you get an instant receiver as soon as we get a data engine.
Yep, sounds good.
Here, let me find the link for the Jurassic board. I'll put it up here. It's interesting, when I went to buy the board, the guy wrote me back from Jurassic and said, well, we're not allowed to sell this to anyone who's going to resell it, so you have to certify that you're the end user, otherwise we won't sell you the board.
I see. Well, it's always interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny there.
I presume that if you'd said, no, you're going to resell it, he would charge you several times more.
Well, he claims that their license agreement with Intel does not allow them to sell it to anyone who's going to resell it. But then in the next paragraph, he said, if you're going to put it into one of your products and sell the product, then I can sell you one.
Oh, okay.
Which I thought was kind of weird, because I thought the main reason they didn't want to sell it to somebody who's going to resell it is, well, first of all, they don't want to compete with themselves, but it's subsidized. I'm sure it's subsidized, because I don't think you can buy the parts on this board for the cost that they're selling the board for.
Yep. A lot of those I have a whole stack of things that I've tried that were way under what they were would have cost to build.
Well, there's the link down there to the board for you.
By the way, I still have one of those SOC boards like Jeremy was using.
Oh yeah, the socket board.
I have that whole set too.
So do you have an AD1 adapter as well as the HF1 and HF2 and TX2 boards?
Yes, I do.
Oh, wow. You're like fully equipped out there.
Yeah, except for that one little glitch that I think is a power supply.
So is your IQ2 down then?
Yes, it's down right now. I was listening to it and got a little whistle and then it stopped working. But I have tested sideways around it. I don't have that one power cable that I was going to ask you to bring one along to the DCC. That tiny, it's like 2.3 millimeters or something.
Oh, the one that plugs directly into HF2? Okay, I don't have any cables, but I can bring you the connector.
Well, the connector is all I really need.
Yeah, and you know, if something's wrong with that, we got spare parts, we could get it fixed for you.
Yep. Well, I was figuring this would... I have all the pieces, so I should be able to get something cobbled together to test.
So do you think we should do the program, the update testing on the IQ2, or should maybe we should use a Max 10 since that's going to be closer to what we're really going to have?
Yeah, I think it'd be better to do it on the Max 10 if you if we could figure out how to hook in your boards to this. Well, actually, just if we can load the FPGA, that's all we really need to know right now.
Well, this board that I gave you the link to has an HSMC connector. So if you have an AD1, you can plug your HF1 or HF2 and TX2 onto the AD1 and right onto this board.
Oh, very good.
So you're all set.
Well, I have to get one of those. Well, Scotty, I hate to break up the thing, but I need to keep my session close to an hour. So I'm going to say 7:30.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks, Dave, for running everything and getting here on time. I can't seem to be able to do that myself here. Yeah, and it is a good idea to keep it to about an hour. Otherwise, we could go on and on, right? So anyway, welcome to the new people. Thanks for coming. And I hope it was interesting or informative or one of the two anyway.